Good evening. My name is Kayla Basile, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are gathered today in a place that lies within the traditional territory of the Susquehannock, the Shawnee, and the Lenape Indigenous peoples who inhabited this land for centuries prior to the arrival of European settlers. On behalf of the Clark Forum, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, the Women's and Gender Resource Center, the Departments of Philosophy and Political Science, the Program and Policy Studies, and the Churchill Fund, I would like to welcome you to tonight's lecture, Storytelling, Emotion Culture, and Performative Citizenship in the Undocumented Immigrants Movement. Immigration is one of the most prominent and emotionally charged political issues of our time. Beyond legislation and political jargon, it has become an issue of human rights and American identity. Narratives of families separated, children locked in cages, and illegal immigrants stealing jobs are driving the debate over immigration reform. The undocumented immigrants movement has become an active force campaigning for expanded rights for immigrants. However, government action is at a standstill. An increasingly volatile political environment makes the position of immigrants in American society even more unstable. With the presidential election fast approaching, immigration will continue to have a powerful and emotional impact on all aspects of American culture. I was recently told by a friend who goes to school in the South that many of her born and raised Southern friends were taught in high school that the Civil War was fought over the economy and not slavery. I was shocked. How can Americans in New York and Kentucky have been told completely different origin stories and have completely different conceptions of how modern America came to be? The stories we are told about our country have a huge impact on what we think it means to be American and how we voice our political beliefs. Narratives is more powerful than fact in motivating our decisions. I think if we all looked at the stories and narratives behind each piece of legislation and social movement, we would understand where our political opponents are coming from and why we believe what we do. Our speaker tonight, Catherine Abrams, will talk about her research on the role that narratives play in social movements. Catherine Abrams is Herma Hill Kay Distinguished Professor of Law at UC Berkeley School of Law. She teaches constitutional law, feminist jurisprudence, social justice in the law, and law and emotions. She's currently writing a book on her research on the mobilization of undocumented immigrants in Arizona. Abrams worked as a clerk for Judge Frank M. Johnson of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and has held several teaching positions at institutions including Boston University, Cornell University, and Northwestern University Law School. She's been published in the Berkeley Larraza Law Journal, the Columbia Journal of Gender and Law, and the Denver University Law Review, among several other publications and edited volumes. She's received several teaching accolades and has been awarded for her service to women. A question and answer session will follow the lecture, so please hold all questions until then. The Clark Forum welcomes differences of opinion expressed politely, thoughtfully, and succinctly. Disruptive behavior or harassment of the speaker, members of the Dickinson community, or audience members will not be tolerated. As a show of respect for our speaker and everyone in the audience, please stay until the end of the program, including the question and answer session. I ask that you please silence all cell phones and other electronic devices. In the case of an emergency, please note that the handicap accessible exits are located on the west side of the building. And now please join me in welcoming Professor Catherine Abrams.
I'm using this, so I don't need that. I am so glad to be here. I've had a wonderful opportunity to see your campus, which is lovely, and to engage in some terrific discussions already with colleagues here. I want to say special thanks to the Clark Forum for hosting me in such a really thoughtful way, and to Kayla for the lovely introduction. So imagine the following scene. It's shortly after noon on a sweltering July day in Phoenix, Arizona, and a crowd has convened outside the Sandra Day O'Connor Federal Courthouse because it's the last day of the trial of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, whose name you may have heard because President Trump pardoned him, and he is a virulently anti-immigrant sheriff of Maricopa County, the area surrounding Phoenix. He's been charged with constitutional violations for the racial profiling of Latinos. Four adults on this plaza, introduce themselves in an impromptu press conference, making the statements like the one offered by Leticia Ramirez. "I've been undocumented for 18 years, and I'm a mother of three kids. Arpaio has been chasing our community, chasing our people, and I'm here to tell him that I'm going to make his job easy. I'm not going to stand for what he's doing to our community, so come and get me." With that, these four undocumented immigrants unfurled a banner bearing the words "Sin papeles, sin miedo," without papers, without fear, and placed it in the middle of a busy urban street and sat down on it, awaiting arrest. Whoops. This is the... Right. And that is what the actual demonstration looked like. It was... That was right at the beginning of my research for this project. And it was just a stunning scene. The organization that they were part of circled around them for about 10 minutes. And then the director sort of hugged each of the activists. And the police stepped up sort of one step at a time like this. And until they pulled them off the banner in a very careful, very choreographed effort. No civil rights era Bull Connor stuff here. They were very careful with them. They put them in the paddy wagon and took them off to Joe Arpaio's jail. So many things impressed me about this scene, but the most striking of it was that these protesters were all undocumented immigrants. And I should say, not dreamers either, not teenagers. These were people a little younger than me. They were mostly in their 30s, and some of them in their 40s, maybe one of them. In our culture, protest and other social movement activity are assumed to be the purview of citizens. Citizens are understood to have the greatest stake in what happens in this country. And more directly to the point, they are the people to whom state actors, decision makers at all levels, are accountable through the electoral process. Yet these individuals without citizenship status, without, for those people, even any formal right to be present in the United States, were organizing and were undertaking civil disobedience, one of the most defiant and risky forms of social movement activity. Not that, only that, but they were doing it in an environment where immigrants were particularly embattled. They certainly faced the incursions of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, but during the first decade of the 2000s, they also faced a legislative effort known as enforcement by attrition, which some of you may have heard about. This is a frankly acknowledged effort by state governments, like there's no denying what they're doing, they're very straightforward about it, to make undocumented immigrants feel so unwelcome and so bereft of any indicia of belonging that they would quote-unquote self-deport to their countries of origin. This effort had culminated in Arizona in 2010 in the passage of SB 1070, which some of you may remember because it was the most virulently anti-immigrant statute in the country at that time, although Georgia and Alabama later surpassed it. A statute that criminalized undocumented presence and undocumented employment and imposed sanctions on any citizen who harbored, transported, or assisted undocumented immigrants and authorized law enforcement officials to demand papers from anyone they suspected of being undocumented. So this bold, defiant act of protest on that street outside the courthouse raised what was for me a riveting, challenging question. How does a group of people lacking in any formal legal status and denied any incident of membership by the state in which they reside develop the internal sense of authorization and the external legitimation necessary to form an engaged, effective social movement? So I spent 4 years trying to investigate this empirically, as an observer and sometimes a participant observer with several organizations, social movement organizations of undocumented immigrants in Phoenix, Arizona. And I did close to 100 interviews with activists and allies. And so tonight I want to share with you what I found in answer to this question. The short answer is that this surprising mobilization is the product of skillful and creative work by a set of organizations that were committed not only to fighting for undocumented immigrants in Phoenix and Arizona, but to enabling undocumented people themselves to be the voice and to take the leadership in that struggle. How these organizations formed and how undocumented community members found their way to them is part of the story that I tell in my book. But the part of the story that I see as central and that I'm going to focus on tonight is how these organizations cultivated in undocumented participants, most of whom had not engaged in politics before, either in their countries of origin or in the United States, and many of whom were accustomed to living far below the radar screen of public visibility. The sense of authorization necessary to turn outward into public life and the sense of legitimacy necessary to engage confidently with state actors and with the public over their demands. So I'm going to argue that there are three central practices that organizations use to transform undocumented community members into activists: storytelling, emotion culture, and performative citizenship. So experiential storytelling is the most pervasive tactic in the undocumented immigrants movement. And I should say, these pictures are all of activists in Arizona that I've worked with at one time or another. And this young woman, who's actually quite remarkable, has gone on. She sort of cut her teeth on the Arizona Dream Act Coalition, and she's gone on to found her own social justice organization, which is for undocumented people, which is quite interesting. It's not that usual to have an undocumented person as the first founder of an organization, and she's done that. So storytelling is the most pervasive tactic in the undocumented immigrants movement. Many groups, from civil rights activists at the mass meetings of the civil rights movement to second wave feminists at consciousness-raising sessions to LGBT activists coming out, have used stories to introduce themselves to the public and to make their demands concrete. Undocumented immigrants do this too in many kinds of public actions, but storytelling also plays a really important role within organizations where stories are shared constantly in preparing new participants to become public-facing activists. Storytelling helps to authorize new activists in several ways. First, it fights the internalized stigma produced by anti-immigrant politics and introduces new accounts of what it means to be undocumented. Undocumented community members often struggle with ambivalent feelings about their status. They know that they're working really hard to create a better life for themselves and their families, whether by holding down two jobs or learning a new language and culture at school. They may also be active in their churches or in supporting their neighbors. But the talk surrounding policies like Arizona's attrition by enforcement is full of negative stereotypes about immigrants. They're lawbreakers. They're drains on the public fisc. They bring the drug wars from Mexico over the border. And so sociologists have demonstrated that undocumented people, despite their own sense that they're doing what they should be doing in their lives, can internalize these negative stereotypes, leading to a situation about where they feel rather unsure about whether they deserve more than they're getting in a state like Arizona. Storytelling within organizations offers new and different narratives about what it means to be undocumented. People share stories of pain and fear and exclusion, which the new recruits can relate to, but their stories emphasize other things as well: the personal strengths that have helped them navigate their situation, the support that they found from parents or teachers, and the things that they've been able to accomplish despite the obstacles that they face. One young woman put it this way. She says, in this organization, we come together as a community. We hear everybody's stories. Seeing an undocumented young adult, just 2 years older than me, graduate from Arizona State University with a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering, it's like, wow, how do you do it? I want to be like you. Tell me how you did it. Tell me how you found money for school. Tell me how it is that you passed all these things and you still had time to go to work because you were the head of your household. Hearing these stories, it's real amazing. It's just multi-inspiring. Stories also begin to form bonds among undocumented community members that will be crucial to their continued participation. Stories of struggle and progress against the odds. When undocumented people hear these stories, they realize, sometimes for the first time, that there are lots of other people in their situation who share their experiences. Undocumented immigrants, as a result, develop a kind of family feeling within their organizations that makes them want to be there and that gives them a sense of greater strength and support. One activist recalled her own experience telling her stories when she first joined an organization. She said, I remember my very first meeting. I ended up telling my story and bawling my eyes out in front of these strangers, because it was her first meeting. It just felt amazing being able to talk about this to a group of people that know exactly what you're feeling. They held my hand. They told me and my sister that it would be okay. And that's when I knew that I wanted to create this kind of safe space for other people as well. So that's another thing that they get out of storytelling. The emotional bonds that are fostered in new activists also help them realize that they can rely on each other as they turn outward into public action. That their individual voice is amplified by the voices of others, that they can rely on each other to stay as safe as possible, meaning that there's a community that will fight their detention and their deportation if they're apprehended in the course of their visible movement activities. As this last point suggests, undocumented storytelling also prepares new activists for the work that they're going to do as they turn outward into public activity. Undocumented storytelling gives them practice in self-narration and in the sharing of difficult emotions, something that I call emotional transparency, that's going to be necessary in public life. They learn, as this young woman did, that it's not strange or embarrassing if they show emotion as they describe the hard things that have happened to them in their lives. As this last point suggests, undocumented immigrants are learning lessons through storytelling that explain to them the importance of their role in the movement and how storytelling helps them achieve it. In organizations, they're exposed not only to stories, but what I call meta-narratives, or stories about stories, that circulate among activists, often informally. These meta-narratives explain to new activists why stories are crucial to the movement and why this means that undocumented activists are crucial to the movement, even if they have absolutely no previous experience. So the first thing meta-narratives do is describe storytelling as the best way to persuade. Undocumented activists think that nothing does the task of persuading members of the public like storytelling does. And this is true first because it has a concreteness that more abstract arguments tend to lack. A young activist described it this way. A lot of people just assume that crossing the border is hard. But unless you've walked through the desert yourself, unless you felt that kind of thirst or saw those little graves out there from the people that just didn't make it, people don't really know what it means to cross the desert. Storytelling also has a capacity for engaging its listeners emotionally that is vital to winning support. A dreamer recalled her own experience about how this emotional engagement worked when she said, "So I found myself tearing up in front of 300 people, And then I look out and I see that these 300 people are also crying and they're hugging each other. That's when I knew that my message would come across the most strongly, when there was that kind of emotional bond between the speaker and the listener. These meta-narratives, or stories about stories, also describe storytelling as a resource that virtually anyone in the movement who has lived as an undocumented person has, and that's crucial to policymaking around immigration. And this particular meta-narrative can be summed up in a phrase that is used pervasively in institutions, and that is, everyone has a story. And everyone does have a story. In these organizations, it means everyone undocumented has a story that's essential to the movement. And so here's an example of how this meta-narrative circulates among activists and the kind of work it does. And this story was told to me by a teenage activist in one of the voter registration campaigns I'm going to describe later. She says, I was talking to a volunteer and we were waiting for the bus or the light rail. And I was like, so what's your story? Why are you here? And she's like, I don't have a story. Throughout my trainings, they told me that everybody has a story. So I started asking her questions. She told me why she got involved. Her family's undocumented. One of her brothers went to jail. And after that, I told her that was her story. And she could use it when she went out to talk to her friends or to strangers. Then a few days ago, she was out registering people to vote. They came back in the van and she said, we were trying to register this guy and he didn't want to. And so I told him my story and totally changed his mind. And he registered to vote. So this young woman said, it's like giving that voice to people that they didn't know that they had. Anyone can use that voice to persuade people. So storytelling helps to convince prospective activists that they are resourceful individuals supported by a strongly bonded community who have a vital role to play in the movement. Even if you understand this role, it may not be easy to play it. It's really difficult to learn to expose your vulnerabilities day after day after day. It's difficult to engage in a public life in which you might be subject to increased risks of apprehension, detention, and deportation, and exposed to stigmatizing depictions by people who are your opponents. It's difficult to struggle with a government that doesn't see you the way you see yourself and only rarely responds to your political claims. This is where the second practice, the creation of robust emotion cultures within social movement organizations, comes into play. So when I say cultures, I mean an environment that is created by explicit and implicit practices in which members take part, sometimes intentionally and sometimes more intuitively. These cultures serve undocumented immigrants both by fostering mobilizing emotions, ones that help them go out and become activists, and by fighting demobilizing emotions, fear or frustration or disappointment, that might make further activism by undocumented people difficult. An essential part of the emotion culture of undocumented organizations consists of modeling and constructive response. Experienced activists model emotional transparencies, candidly and poignantly depicting their own struggles when they share stories, and also talking more casually about their apprehensions, their nervousness, their doubts. One of the things I noticed about meetings at the Arizona Dream Act Coalition is whenever somebody stood up to talk to the group, if they were feeling nervous about speaking to the group, or if they were feeling nervous because the group wanted them to speak in Spanish and they were more comfortable speaking in English, they would share that nervousness with their colleagues as a sort of demonstrative act of emotional transparency. New participants are also supported in their own efforts at emotional disclosure. When new people are telling their stories, they get hugs, they get encouraging touches, and they get, you know, sort of supportive vocalizations and the absolute ubiquitous feature of this movement, which is the supportive snap. Okay, so these disclosures and this situation of interpersonal support occurs against a larger backdrop of energy, optimism, and capability. Activists in the organization that I've worked with convey a steady sense that their know-how and solidarity are resources that will sort of set them up well against virtually any problem. And they have really interesting strategies for instilling that kind of confidence in new recruits. One that I noticed in my work with organizations, particularly the Dream Act Coalition, but others as well, was the use of aphorisms or expressions to help new participants interpret negative feelings that they were having in positive ways. And one that's of these aphorisms that's used a lot, particularly in youth organizations, is working outside your comfort zone is the way that you grow. And this is a really useful aphorism because a lot of people who are becoming activists for the first time feel absolutely overwhelmed and over their head by the demands that are made on them. You know, it's sort of watch one, do one, teach one. They're constantly expanding their range and teaching it to other people. And so organizations work hard to help them see feeling at sea in a positive way. And so working outside your comfort zone is the way that you grow is a sort of organizer's version of pain is weakness leaving the body. You know, it sort of gets them to feel that being overwhelmed is actually a sign of something good happening. They're growing as activists. The most intentional or concerted part of emotion cultures that I've encountered are the strategies that organizations use to combat the negative emotions associated with being in a high-risk, high-frustration movement, which is the way I would characterize this movement. They are fighting fear that can constantly be triggered by the possibility of apprehension, and disappointment and frustration that meet a lot of social movements. But to be frank, the undocumented immigrants movement has had a lot of this, particularly on the national level, because there have been so many times that they've come really close, like with the DREAM Act in 2010 or comprehensive immigration reform in 2013, and then have not gotten what they thought was just on the horizon. Some of this work involves something that is called emotives. And emotives is a phrase that was coined by an anthropologist named William Reddy. And this is, emotives are descriptions of emotions and responses to emotions that also function normatively. That is, that tell activists how they're supposed to be feeling. And a good example of this emotive is we thrive on adversity. That's something that undocumented immigrants often say within their organization. Now, that's pretty wild. Not so many people thrive on adversity, feel so great when they encounter adversity. But this expression at least provides a signal to people about what they're supposed to be feeling when they encounter adversity. The most effective emotives connect specific emotion states to positive attributes of activists' newly formed identity. And a good example of this is the best known emotive in this movement, we're undocumented and unafraid. This emotive is not descriptively accurate all the time. A number of activists have said to me that they've declared it adamantly at moments where their pulse was running at about 170 and they had a dry mouth and they were really concerned about what was going to happen next. But it describes the emotion state to which they aspire, and it connects that emotion state to an identity that they've come to value, that is, their identities as undocumented, which in Arizona has been a way of characterizing their status neutrally or positively as compared with being called illegal, which is the way that the state usually refers to them. Embracing this emotive helps activists work toward the state of being unafraid in ways that work differently for different activists. So I've got a couple different examples here. One activist said that declaring that she was undocumented and unafraid encouraged her to think of the strongest, most positive part of an ambivalent response that she had to her situation. And she said, even now, there are things that make me afraid. I mean, speaking publicly is very scary. Sharing your story is very scary. Having a one-on-one civil debate with an anti-immigrant person, which in Arizona is not always a civil debate, can be very scary. It's terrifying, but I refuse to be a victim of my circumstances. I refuse to be turned into this little person because of a situation that I'm in. Another activist described the way in which undocumented and unafraid was actually performative. Repeating it over time helped to bring that emotion of being unafraid into being. And she said this, in the beginning, it was, I guess, like an empowerment phrase. Even if people were still afraid, they didn't have to show they were afraid to the public. Even if they were dying inside, they put on this face where it was, you know what, I'm not afraid. As people started telling their stories and started coming out, they started noticing it wasn't really something to be afraid of. And it was something you could live with, that you were okay with. And when you said so, when you said you were not afraid, people believed you. And so it, even if it started as an empowerment phrase, something people said to sort of fortify themselves, it became true over the years. There are a range of other organizational practices that I saw operating that sort of work to diffuse negative, demobilizing emotions, like celebrating small victories in the course of a larger campaign that might have an uncertain outcome, or encouraging activists to extend the time horizon of their expectations. I have children who are about the age of many of the activists I was working with, and I often commented to activists that for my children, like next month is way too long. And I would hear these activists say things like, this may not happen in my lifetime. This is like, you know, a 20-year-old saying that. But it might happen in my children's lifetime. So the extension of the time horizon is remarkable. They also have practices like cultivating counter-emotions. And this is very interesting. Sometimes in a really difficult action, undocumented groups will do something that gives rise to a spontaneous feeling of joy that enlivens them when they're doing something really hard. And a great example of this was a vigil that I witnessed at Eloy, which is one of the most notorious immigrant detention facilities out in this barren desert wasteland area in Arizona. And a group of undocumented people that I worked with had marched 60 miles into the desert to hold this vigil at Eloy. And the director of the organization that they were part of had a microphone, and he said to them, there were three or four of the activists who had children in this detention facility, adult children. They were people my age. And he said, speak to your loved ones because we believe that they can hear you in there. And so these people just poured out their feelings for their children over this PA system. I mean, talk about the disclosure of painful emotions in public. It was really something. They were speaking in Spanish, and I kid you not, even the monolingual English speakers in the crowd were crying because it was just so moving. And then after all of this was over, the director of the organization turned on a boombox, and it played dancing music. And everybody slowly sort of started to sway in place. And we noticed that inside we could see a window in the detention facility, and somebody was holding up a white card, and they were moving it from side to side. And before we know it, people felt like they were dancing with the people who were detained inside. And it was a moment of release and relief. And so cultivating those kinds of counter-emotions is really, really important. If storytelling and emotion cultures are practices that authorize undocumented immigrants to undertake public-facing action, and then they follow them, these practices follow them into the field, and they use them as they continue their work. The third practice I'm going to talk about, performative citizenship, works once activists are already in the political sphere, contending with state actors and introducing themselves to the public. Performative citizenship works to counter the impression that immigrants have no place on the political landscape of their adoptive countries by placing them in visible political roles that are conventionally occupied by citizens or associated by most Americans with citizenship. These practices are performative in the simple sense that they're performances, public enactments that are citizen-like. Activists are, in a sense, saying, this is what citizens do, and leaving members of the public to conclude, they're not as different as we thought. But they're also performative in a more theoretical sense. Those of you who have studied J.L. Austin or Judith Butler recognize that which is performative is that which has a quality of bringing into being what it declares, whether that's a marriage in the sense of the declarative statement, I do, or whether it is a system of gender that isn't naturally given but is produced and reproduced by performances of gender in the world. The tactics or acts that I'm going to describe are performative in that sense, the sense that they, acting in a citizen-like way, brings undocumented immigrants closer to their goals of membership or legalization. These acts sometimes have this effect by reshaping the way that undocumented people are viewed by the public or elected officials. The performance challenges public actors to think about what undocumented immigrants would be like as members of the polity. But they're also performative in that they help reconstitute or remake activists as political participants. When activists occupy the roles and take part in public debate and public action, this changes the way that they think about themselves and their relationship to political community. They're sort of walking the walk, and that in and of itself makes them feel like participants. But these tactics also have longer-term reconstituting effects because these citizen-like roles provide undocumented people with an insider's understanding of institutions and processes. This gives them a sense of legitimacy, a feeling of political confidence, and belonging. So in my work in Arizona, I've seen at least three different modes of performative citizenship that I describe as institutional participation, oppositional participation, and rights bearing. So in the last part of my talk, I want to describe each of these kinds of performative citizenship. Now, I should say that these modes of performative citizenship don't always work the way that I've just described. They don't always work as planned. And one of the things that I trace out in my book through a study of different campaigns is when they work and when they don't. And I can talk a little bit more about that in Q&A if people are interested. But at their most effective, they can legitimate undocumented people in the eyes of the public and give them a citizen-like confidence in their roles. Okay, institutional participation is probably the easiest form of performative citizenship to understand. Undocumented immigrants take on roles with informal institutions and processes that most of us intuitively understand to define citizens and citizenship. This happened first in 2007 to 2010 when Dreamers first began to testify before Congress. The public was impressed not only by their stories, but by their composed self-presentation and by their commitment to extending the understanding of legislators. Dreamers themselves, however, had an even bigger transformation. They learned about the legislative process, and they developed their own networks among congresspeople. These young people were not satisfied simply to be escorted from place to place by their documented handlers. They got to know congresspeople. They got to know their staffs in ways that permitted them to act more autonomously going forward. Perhaps the most successful example of institutional participation that I've encountered is the involvement of undocumented youth in civic engagement campaigns. That is, in efforts to increase the registration and turnout of voters. Now, civic engagement campaigns have been happening for a long time, and they've been an instrument of national organizations run by documented Latinos, like Mi Familia Vota or Voto Latino, that are intended to engage the Latino vote, not just to transform the electorate, but actually to have effects in the direction of immigration reform. This has been a long-term strategy. But one of the things that organizations like those and like the organizations that I worked with that are sort of led by undocumented people did, which was different, is that they engaged undocumented people, usually young people, as canvassers. And this was just a genius move because undocumented immigrants, of course, are not permitted to vote, but they can use their energy and they can use their stories to persuade Latino citizens and other allies to vote. And youth are a wonderful, wonderful example of how this can be done because they have the energy to walk for miles and miles in the Arizona sun and persuade their neighbors. And I, in the course of being a participant observer in this movement, canvassed with some of these youth canvassers. And I can tell you, it was unlike anything else I did in this research. It was exhausting. And, you know, fortunately, many of the people whose houses we went to offered us bottles of water, but otherwise it was like us out there. It was 115 degrees. It was something. And these young people did this day in, day out, for, you know, the 4 or 5 months of the most intense part of the campaign. The performance of a role customarily performed by august institutions like the League of Women Voters gave them a kind of role legitimacy in the minds of the public, and their persistent effort in the difficult and really unglamorous work of going door to door demonstrated their civic commitment. So people in Arizona stood up and took notice. Now, I have to say, the legislature in Arizona also stood up and took notice and actually enacted laws that restricted the roles of canvassers. So they clearly understood what a potent tool this was. For the canvassers themselves, though, the effects were even greater because they developed elaborate knowledge of the institutions in which seats were being filled, of the electoral process and how it functioned. But even more than that, they developed a sense of being participants in that system, even though they were not permitted to vote. Some described feeling connected to the political process, like the teenager who said, "I learned that my voice counts, and I had to lose my shyness so that I can inform my community what's going on and I can get other youth involved in it, because we are the future of America." Imagine this, right? A person who has been denied any form of status in this country saying, "We are the future of America, and if we don't get involved, then nobody else is." Some of them also talked about the influence that they ended up exercising over the political process, even though they couldn't vote in it. One young woman said, "Even though I might not have the right to vote, I have made the choice to empower those who can." Or there was a young man who said to me, "Every single time I go to a house and I manage to get their vote," and I should add, this is not a vote for a particular candidate, it's just getting them to register to vote, "I feel like I'm voting, and so I feel like I've voted 1,000 times. Most interesting to me, many of these canvassers not only end up understanding the notion of electoral accountability and how politicians who are elected are accountable to their constituents. But they believe that accountability extends to them as well, because they either are already members of the communities that they canvass in, or they come to feel like members. Often canvassers will return three times over the course of an election cycle to the same blocks and the same doors to make sure people understand, to make sure they've got an early ballot, to make sure they're actually voting on election day. A canvasser put it this way: I can go to any street and I can tell you the neighborhood wanted this. And when I see that the roads are cracked, they're old, they need fixing, I want to go up to somebody and tell them, you know what, this is going on, and the community wants this and this and this. You know how I know? I knock on these doors. Because often in these conversations, they talk about immigration, they talk about Sheriff Arpaio, and they talk about other things like public parks and streetlights. He says, this is what's burning inside me. I want to hold somebody responsible for what's going on. Or as another canvasser said of political officials, and this is an undocumented person speaking, at the end of the day, you work for us. You work for the community. Sometimes work with informal institutions has proven unavailing, as when Congress failed to pass the DREAM Act or comprehensive immigration reform. So activists decide to place pressure on institutions by mobilizing outside those institutions. Here they draw on another, more controversial but still venerated conception of citizenship: the role of citizen as protester. This vision of oppositional citizenship and the commitment it embodies have been honed in many of the United States' most successful social movements. For many, oppositional citizenship starts with a very simple, accessible action. They take place in a march, or they take part in a march. Now, I hit the wrong button here. There we go. Marches. All right. Marches summon many strong feelings on the part of participants, but some of the most noteworthy involve a sense of solidarity and a connection to their community. This new activist said it this way: you think, oh, I'm the only one feeling these emotions, and nobody else knows what I'm feeling. But no matter where you look around, you see the same emotion on everyone's face. And then it comes to the point that I'm doing this not only for myself, but for those who are afraid to come out. It gives you this boost of confidence, this I can do this. I'm doing something good for myself and for the community. And for those who march over time, and most of the activists that I spoke to can't count on two hands the number of marches they've been in, and I certainly can't count on two hands the number of marches that I was in just during 4 years of research. And they say things like a dreamer who put this really well: now that I'm more aware, I understand that my life depends on this. This is the life of my family. So I feel more compelled to do something. It means more to me. Like when I shout, I feel like I shout from my heart, we can do this. Si se puede. We are together. And people need to hear us. They need to hear us shout. And so there's a sense here not only of a relationship to one's own community, but of a relationship to a larger community that needs to hear one's message. Some participants may escalate from marches to direct action. Direct action might be a mock citizenship ceremony. It might be a sit-in, a hunger strike, a march into the desert like the one that I described. Direct action is understood by a lot of activists as an extension of the activities that they use within institutions, in that what they're doing is intended to spur the accountability of elected officials. This wonderful quote comes from an adult activist, a woman about my age, who migrated to the United States as an adult. And she said, during their election, representatives offered to help us with immigration. And then when they're in power, they no longer give us what was promised. Boy, that's a sentiment a lot of Americans have. And it is then up to us to go to them with other tactics so that they can remember we are waiting for what they promised us. We need to pressure them so that we will be heard and treated equally because we are a very important part of this country, so that they take us into account and they see our value. You know, the self-possession and sense of membership in that is really, really interesting. A smaller number of activists undertake the most risky form of oppositional activity, and that is civil disobedience. This is sometimes viewed as the highest form of commitment by undocumented activists because it involves the intentional violation of a law in order to expose the injustice of that law or to expose the injustice of a broader immigration policy. It also is the riskiest because when they break a law, they are going to be arrested. And that arrest at least exposes them to a greater degree than other forms of activism do, to the risk of detention and deportation. That is, they could be transferred by the police to ICE, which then has to decide what to do about them. And this is much more likely to happen in Arizona, a state where the police cooperate with ICE, than in a place like California, where, you know, the state has basically said we're not cooperating. So civil disobedience can be a risky bet with the public in terms of legitimation. For some people, it is just a bridge too far. Breaking the law for some people is not okay even for citizens, but it grates even more when it's performed by people who aren't citizens. But for others, particularly people who remember and respect the role of civil disobedience in early social movements, the physical exertion and the risk-taking that people undergo in doing civil disobedience legitimates activists by demonstrating the strength of their commitment. For activists, the effects of civil disobedience are really potent. And this is why I think a lot of undocumented immigrant organizations undertake it, despite the fact that it's a kind of roll of the dice with the public, particularly in a place like Arizona. You're not quite sure what the uptake is going to be. But for activists, it's really galvanizing. Preparation for the act, the soul searching and the careful political calculations and sometimes legal calculations about undertaking it. And in the action itself, the what can be an hours-long wait to actually be arrested. And in the action that I showed you at the very beginning, it took maybe an hour and a half for these activists to finally be arrested. And in some acts like sit-ins at congressional offices, it can take all day. For, you know, when the offices close, that's when Capitol Police come and decide they're going to arrest the people sitting in. This, both the waiting and the calculation, immeasurably reaffirm their sense of commitment and authorization in the movement. Here, in the first quote, a very thoughtful young woman talked about what she went through in deciding whether she was willing to take part in an effort to stop a deportation bus by kneeling in front of it or by tying herself to the chassis of the bus. And this woman was very, very interesting in that, unlike most of the youth I work with, she had actually been placed in deportation proceedings before when she was in a car that was going over the speed limit and was stopped by police, and all the people in the car were undocumented. And she was put in deportation proceedings, which she managed to fight, and they were ultimately closed. But as she was contemplating this action, she said, it was always in the back of my mind, like, what if they can reopen my case? My case was terminated by a judge. And my attorney had told me, if it's terminated, it means if they want to put you in proceedings again, it has to be a new case. They can't open it or reopen it. But I was still like, what if they deport me? But it made sense for me that time with the bus. If I would ever get arrested, I would do it in front of the bus. Because it was a sense of, like, if I'm able to stop somebody's deportation, I'm okay with being deported because I know that my community is going to be there for me, that is, trying to fight my deportation, regardless. Here's another young woman who talked about her experience in civil disobedience. And she was an early activist who sat in at, I think, Harry Reid's offices while the initial DREAM Act was being considered in an effort to get them to bring the DREAM Act to the floor of the Senate. And she said about the day she spent there sitting in, as things were getting closer and closer and we started getting our warnings from the police, it was like I was in Disneyland, because when you go up on the roller coaster, how you start feeling, it felt like, oh, we're going up. And then you see the entire seaport from the top, and then they drop you. That's how I felt. I mean, what kind of a metaphor could be more American than comparing civil disobedience by an undocumented person to Disneyland, right? But that was the metaphor that she reached for. When they are able to carry out the action successfully, that is to master their greatest fear of arrest and deportation and make their statement, there is a gigantic effect in terms of their sense of empowerment. And here's the woman using the Disneyland metaphor to talk about how she felt when she was finally arrested and they were taking her out. She said, I felt like I have done everything possible for me to fix this situation. That is the situation of undocumented people, of dreamers in particular. So if I get deported tomorrow, it's fine. When I got arrested, that was the first time I felt free in a very long time. And it was ironic because I was in zip ties that is holding her hands bound together. Activists may also be buoyed after a civil disobedience because there's a vicarious effect of commitment and participation that spreads throughout the entire community. And sometimes organizations will actually decide to undertake civil disobedience at a demonstration or in the middle of a street because it fires up their community. And here is another woman that was arrested in the Capitol, a DREAM Act protester, who described what happened when they went back to Arizona after their protest in Washington, D.C. She says, when we came back, we had tons of people going to support us at the Capitol. We did a rally at the Capitol, that is at the Arizona Capitol in Phoenix. I saw a lot of other youth were starting to be a lot more empowered. And from there on, you started to see a lot of youth being like, I would do this or I would do that. I mean, they were willing. A bit after that, we did a month-long camp and encampment outside John McCain's office, and we literally slept outside of McCain's office for almost a month. Folks were willing to do that. That was not the case in 2009. So that's what all of these forms of performative citizenship culminating in civil disobedience can accomplish. A final citizen-like role that activists take on is the role of rights bearer. The assertion of rights is viewed in the U.S. as one of the central prerogatives of citizens. Undocumented residents have some rights as well, a fact that is not well known either to immigrants or to citizens who aren't familiar with the Constitution, because the Constitution, in fact, describes some rights in terms of broad prohibitions on the government, like the First Amendment. It says what the government can't do. It doesn't say who that duty is owed to. Or like the 14th Amendment, which contains the Due Process and Equal Protection Clause, where protection is guaranteed to persons and not to citizens. So one way that citizens have learned to assert rights that they hold under the Constitution is through Know Your Rights trainings that are designed to instruct them in how to manage law enforcement encounters. Some of you may have heard about this because when the Trump administration came in, Know Your Rights trainings became ubiquitous throughout the country. Previously, they were more common in places like Arizona that had a lot of police collaboration with ICE. For many activists, learning that they have some rights when they thought they had none. For example, that they don't have to tell law enforcement officers anything more than their name or address. They don't have to tell them where they were born. And they can ask for a translator or they can ask for a lawyer before signing anything like a voluntary deportation form, which has resulted in a lot of people getting deported when they don't fully understand the consequences. Learning that they have these kinds of rights proves to be surprisingly empowering for them. So it can socialize activists to a more rights-based, procedural, you might say culturally American, way of thinking about encounters with police. And this was really interesting to hear about, particularly for adult activists whose orientations toward law enforcement had sometimes been cultivated in their countries of origin. And this is what one guy in his 40s said to me. He said after his Know Your Rights training, "We don't have to become friends of the officer. We have the choice to answer some of the questions and not everything. In our own countries, we believe that when somebody has authority, we have to cooperate or even incriminate ourselves, even if we haven't broken any laws or anything like that. One of the things I've learned here in Arizona is that the only thing I have to say legally is my name and date of birth, and that's it." So it's a different orientation toward law enforcement. But more generally, I think what it gives to undocumented people is a sense of more confidence in entering a law enforcement encounter. Here's how a younger woman, a dreamer, put it. "After the Know Your Rights training, I'm not afraid anymore as I used to be." I think she means I'm not as afraid anymore. "Between my nervousness and not knowing what to do, I really would have given up all the information to the police to make it easier for them to deport me. After the training, I was like, well, you know, I have the right to say no. I have the right to remain silent and say that I want to call a lawyer." A final strategy that exists in the area of rights bearing, which I'll mention just briefly, and it's been much more equivocal in its effects, is that undocumented people have sometimes been named plaintiffs, and organizations have been named plaintiffs in lawsuits against the highest officials in Arizona. For example, the Arizona Dream Act Coalition brought an action against the governor of Arizona who was trying to prevent people with DACA from obtaining driver's licenses. Or another organization that did, an organization called Puente that did the very first protest that I showed you, brought an action against Joe Arpaio for his practice of using workplace raids as a way of not enforcing the offenses of employers, which was what he was supposed to be doing, but of gathering information on undocumented people and using that to prosecute them. And the organization and some of its members were the named plaintiffs. And this is a really interesting action of rights bearing, right? They're not only declaring that they have rights, but they're bringing the highest officials in the state into court for the vindication of those rights. And in some cases, they've won. I mean, the Dreamers won that case for the driver's licenses. And Puente won at least a preliminary injunction that was entered and was operating for a year against Joe Arpaio from doing these workplace raids before, oddly, it was reversed by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is usually a very progressive court. But they do some good. This exercise in rights-bearing has been much, much more equivocal, less successful in giving a sense of confidence and citizen-like feeling to activists. And we can talk about it more in Q&A, but I think part of that is because of how little control immigrants feel in a legal process that's controlled by lawyers and judges rather than activists. So through these strategies, undocumented immigrants have come to form a very robust movement that's not only pushed back on enforcement by attrition in Arizona, but has proved remarkably resilient, even following the election of Donald Trump, something I can talk about, when, as one activist put it, America woke up in Arizona. So thank you for your attention, and I'm really eager to hear your questions.
We'll now begin the question and answer session. Since the event's being recorded, please raise your hand and wait for the mic to get to you to ask your question. Also, as an undergraduate institution, we'll reserve the first questions for students and then open it up for the larger audience. We'll now take the first question.
Hi. So I guess I have a few questions. I haven't gotten it down to one yet, but first, what did you feel that your role was in this research? Because it, you know, you were coming from sort of an objective
outsider position for
Right.
Yes.
And I guess to add on to that, I was curious, like, are you the storyteller of the storytellers?
Okay. Yes. Can I answer that first before you go on?
Yeah, of course.
Because I don't want to forget what as an academic, I'm totally with you. I put together multi-part questions and then sort of wonder how speakers are going to field them. But how far outside this community I am has been a constant source of anxiety, reflection, recalibration to me as I have done this project. I am in a small number of white scholars that work on immigration and the immigrant rights movement. There are more that work on immigration as a legal matter, but socio-legal scholars who study the movement by and large are people that are parts of immigrant communities themselves or their parents were. And there have been many, many times in this research where I have worried about whether I'm the right person to do this research. And one of the ways that I struggled with that is that it took a long time for these communities to accept me. And to not that they were hostile, but they were very guarded. Some of them weren't willing to talk with me for a long time. And I mentioned that my research took 4 years. And I actually believe, part of it was that I wanted to see longitudinally how the research worked or how the movement worked. But beyond that, it took me gaining what they call in sociology, gaining entree, was much harder for me than it would be for most people who study this. Because it was very clear I was not Latino. It was very clear that I was a citizen. It was very clear that I was in my 50s. I was old enough to be the mother of most of these people, and even the people that were the parents of adult children were mostly younger than I was. I came across only a couple people in the movement that were my age peers. So, and when I started my research, I had zero, zip, zilch Spanish. I mean, it's pretty interesting. I've been on committees that award research grants at my organizations, and I have heard people in our sociology department saying, I'm not giving a student a grant to study immigrants if she can't speak Spanish. And so, I realized that this was not a great position to be starting from. And so what I have done is to try to demonstrate that I'm committed and that I'm trustworthy by showing up. And I showed up, and I showed up, and I showed up. And one of the hardest people to get an interview with was the guy that heads Puente, the organization with the four protesters in the middle of the street, which is it's a strongly sort of Mexican culturally based organization, and they looked at me and said, who are you and why should we care? I mean, they didn't say that. They were more cordial than that, but that was what they were thinking. And it took me 3 years to get an interview with this guy. And the way that I finally did it was kind of interesting. I thought, if he doesn't want to talk to me, he might want to talk to my students. And I said to him, you know what? I'm teaching a course on the immigrant rights movement and how young lawyers can partner with that movement as lawyers for social movements. And I think they would really learn how to be good advocates for social movements if they could hear about your experience. And he said, when do you want me to talk to them? And then he gave us 4 hours that year. He gave us 4 hours the year after. You know, it was fantastic. And since I've gone back to Arizona and interviewed him one-on-one, and it hasn't been a problem. But he legitimately wondered who I was. And so just sort of, I don't think that there's anything I could have done other than showing up and just sort of demonstrating my concern. And this implicates the next part of your question. Being very clear that I did not consider myself to be telling their story. These are people who can tell their own stories very well. Thank you very much. And so I agree. And so my attitude was, I can give an account of their story that comes from the position of a social movement scholar, and I can offer that account to some audiences that they might not be reaching in the course of their protest. And so, you know, I think that the people that I've spoken to are happy with that representation. That is, there's no way that I can tell their stories. I mean, you would totally misunderstand the point of storytelling if I presented myself as an authentic storyteller, but I can situate the stories that they tell in a different way that might shed some greater light on the movement.
Thank you. I guess I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
Do you feel personally that your research at all affected your own ideas of being a citizen and being in a democracy?
Absolutely. I can say that I have become a much more active citizen as a result of observing this movement, because I have been, you know, I always voted. I've been a protester. I've mobilized. Oppositional citizenship has been something that I've been involved in. I'm a rights bearer. But, for example, at elections, I always vote, no question. And I hassle my children. I hassle I wear one of those vote stickers. I sign up people to vote. In the first major election after doing this research, I went back to Arizona as a poll observer, something that I'd never done before, because I thought that I needed to sort of participate in elections in some more active way, as well as canvassing with the people that. So yes, it's when I see what the people that I've studied and acted with are willing to do when the nation won't even grant them citizenship and or protection from deportation, most of them, and when they do it at significant risk, I'm shamed as a citizen, and it absolutely has sort of given me impetus to do more.
Hi. So you talked a lot about how undocumented immigrants take agency by protesting, by mobilizing in different ways. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how documented immigrants help and hurt the movement.
Absolutely, yes. So the movement in Arizona distinguishes strongly between undocumented people and people that they call allies. And allies is actually a really large group. I'm an ally, but you also might be an ally if you're like a third generation person. You know, you might be Mexican American, but you and your parents, everyone in your immediate nuclear family, are all documented. And that's a kind of interesting thing, because my guess is a person in that situation is way closer to the experience of an undocumented person than I am, and we're both sort of described as allies. People may be described as members of the community rather than allies if they are citizens who have undocumented parents, because the idea is that They're people who can be reached by immediately in their lives by deportation and detention. And if you are a citizen with undocumented parents, your life is ruptured just the way it would be if you were an undocumented child and your parents left. So that is, and one of the things that I've noticed that's quite interesting is when I've worked with some organizations in California, they draw the lines a little bit differently. They sometimes refer to documented allies as members of the community, which would not happen in Arizona. So what do the documented allies do? In terms of, they are members of all of the organizations that I've mentioned. Even Puente, the more sort of radical anti-deportation, civil disobedient organization, they have documented members. And they do most of the things that the undocumented people do, except they rarely tell stories unless they're a person where a member of their family, even if it's their more distant family, has been deported. They do not position themselves as the public face of the movement unless there is a situation where it's just not a great idea for undocumented people to be the public face. For example, I didn't work a lot in Tucson, but I spent a summer there, and people who do border work, you know, like going into the across the border to leave water or into the immediate border areas, that's considered really, really dangerous stuff for undocumented people. And so sometimes documented people will play that role. They can also, in the early stages of the movement, documented people played a larger role. For example, when attrition by enforcement first began, and these organizations that sort of fostered the leadership of undocumented people were first coming together, a lot of the leadership was done by people who had been active in the Chicano movement. So they were Mexican Americans who were documented themselves but had been political leaders before. Because when SB 1070 was first passed, it was not known whether anyone, say, who was civilly disobedient would be immediately deported. And so people thought, okay, let's try this first with some documented people and see what happens. And so a bunch of Chicano leaders got arrested. And then Dreamers, who were more protected under the Obama administration, even before DACA, started doing it. And then undocumented adults started doing it. As they stepped forward, the documented citizens stepped back. So now that they're more in positions of support, they might be, for example, documented members of the movement are very active in civic engagement campaigns, going door to door. Not all the people that go to door to door are citizens, but usually the ones that tell the stories are. They'll go in teams, and there might be a documented person with an undocumented person. The undocumented person tells the story and takes the lead, and then the documented person sort of fills in and talks a little bit more about the mechanics of the election or something like that. Does that help? Are there more particular examples that... Okay, thank you.
Hello.
Hey.
My name is Noah Davis. I have a question that's more pertaining to more of like the quotes that you've had on the PowerPoint. So I understand that you were like a participant observer, so you're really in direct line and communication with the individuals in this movement and et cetera, et cetera. I wanted to know how, in terms of like the dialogue that you were having, the conversations you were having, how diverse those were in those communities. So were you dealing with people primarily from like a majority, I guess, or were you dealing with individuals who were maybe having more even systemic issues? So like even being like, I guess, like Afro-Latino, being cross-listed or being someone who's having to deal with certain stressors?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. The undocumented activist community in Phoenix is not very ethnically and nationality diverse. Not only are the vast majority from Latin America, but the vast majority are from Mexico. And the way that I encountered more intersectional issues was I did some interviewing with an organization called the Black-Brown Coalition. And so this was not so much Afro-Latino people, but it was African-American people coming together with immigrants. And some of the African-American people were in communities that included immigrants. You know, there are African immigrants in Arizona as well. They were not members of the organizations that I worked with. And I think that may be, and nor I think did were there specific organizations that were directed to the goals of those people in particular. So this, the Black-Brown Coalition was about trying to identify the commonalities that African Americans and African immigrants have with the Latino immigrants who made up most of the movement that I was studying. And where those issues arose most frequently were around issues of over-policing and issues of incarceration. And in the last phase of the movement that I studied, a really interesting campaign called the Not One More Deportation Campaign, which happened after comprehensive immigration reform failed, and the immigrants said, we're not going to get a path to citizenship for people. So what we need to get is the same kind of protection for adults that we have through DACA. And so there was it was a really interesting, very radical campaign because it had an audience of one. It was aimed at President Obama, who was a really interesting target. The relationship between these groups and President Obama was described by one scholar as gothic, and I think that's a really good name for it. They couldn't decide whether he was the hero or the villain. And so they knew, they basically said, the great virtue of Obama is he actually somewhere in there has a moral compass, and he can be shamed, whereas now they just say, you know, like, Trump can't be shamed. There's nothing, or at least not by us, there's nothing that we can do that will shame him. But Obama really thought of himself as a supporter of immigrants. And so this whole campaign was aimed at embarrassing him by saying, okay, you say you're a supporter of immigrants, then why are, you know, 40,000 people getting deported in this unit of time, you know, and so it targeted deportation facilities, it targeted ICE actions. And as people began to think about families being separated, about over-policing, and about the conditions of detention, they began to find allies in the movement for Black Lives, in prison abolitionist organizations. And the Black-Brown Coalition fostered this kind of dialogue as well. By the time my research concluded, Puente, which was an organization that played a big role in the Not One More Deportation campaign, was working actively with local Black Lives Matter organizations. So that's the kind of intersectionality that I studied. I did not see a lot of it in the actual activists that I was interviewing.
Thank you.
We have time for one more question.
Hello. Thanks for being here, first of all.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to go a little bit into the legal realm of things. The Supreme Court just, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, said that the Trump administration was allowed to bar asylum seekers from entering. Roughly, I think that's what happened. Where do you see the fight or the struggle going from here now that the court could at any moment come out with a ruling? What can common activists do about it?
Yes. Okay. So what the court said actually was that the Trump administration could implement some of the plans that it had to stop asylum seekers by requiring them to try first in third countries or things like that during the period while the litigation was pending. So it was not a final decision. It's what lawyers call pendente lite. It means like during the course of the litigation, we are not going to stop this from happening. Now, that's a big loss, right? Because the litigation goes on for years, but it's not the ultimate decision. The situation with asylum seekers is much harder to handle as a protest movement led by the people who are most affected, because they aren't within the country right now. And when they're within the country, they are caged and held in incredibly inhumane conditions. That isn't to say that there haven't been efforts. You all probably remember a year or two ago the caravans that were coming from Latin America. That was a really, really good example of mobilization by potential asylees, often in coordination with organizations in the United States. Not like we were fomenting it. It was an active agency, but it was coordination. There was information sharing. Because what they were trying to do was demonstrate agency and rely on solidarity to increase the numbers of people who felt comfortable coming to the United States seeking asylum. Because there were a lot of stories of people who felt really at risk in their home countries, but didn't know whether it was safe enough to leave. And they were willing to do it with a caravan for solidaristic reasons and because they thought there might be more protection and less exploitation surrounding a big group of people. Now, that was powerful for while they were coming, but it didn't succeed in getting them into the country. And so, you know, I think that more of the work on behalf of asylees is going to have to be done by people who are in this country. That could be undocumented people who understand that they were once in that situation too, claiming a different kind of circumstance and getting over the border in a different way, but they feel a really strong sense of identification. And that's something that's been really interesting in the Dreamer organization that I worked with, the Arizona Dream Act Coalition. In 2014, when they were trying to sort of make the last gasp of the push for comprehensive immigration reform, and there was that uptick in migration of asylees across the border, and it was really interesting. There were a lot of conversations in that group about how important it was that they show solidarity with the people who were coming as asylees, even though they were aware of the fact that this was not helping the cause of immigration reform in Washington. But they saw those people as them. You know, they saw. Similarly, undocumented people have been really reluctant. Like people with the comprehensive immigration reform bill, you might recall that a lot of even the bill that passed the Senate that then got held up in the House included a ton of border security provisions that undocumented people here were really ambivalent about, because they were like, okay, so in exchange for our being safe, our cousins and our neighbors from Mexico can't come. And so I think there is a feeling of solidarity, and they're doing some of that work. And I think that a lot of the work also has to be done by everyone who's here, people who are granted asylum, people who are documented, because I think that it's a little bit like I was describing to somebody. I spent some time in a residency in Australia. And in Australia, people who want to come, who don't have authorization, are held on an island outside Australia. And sadly, the Trump administration is learning from that example. And so people are being held either at the border in horrific conditions, or now they're going to be, some of them have been held in Mexico. The idea that they're going to be asked to try to find asylum in El Salvador, which is one of the most dangerous countries in Latin America, it's just, so those factors mean that the movement on behalf of those people cannot work in exactly the same way the undocumented immigrants movement for people who are already resident here has worked. Thank you all for your attention and your questions.